You're listening to the RBN Energy Blogcast. This is an audio version of RBN's Daily Energy Blog, which is a fun and informative daily commentary on oil, gas, NGL, and renewable markets. Each morning, we cover commodity fundamentals and industry changes to keep you informed of developing trends across the energy landscape.
Thursday, September 29, 2022. Square One, Part 2. Preparations for drilling begin with highly detailed leasing process. Published by Jacob Errol. In days gone by, the common sentiment in the oil patch when prices rose was drill, baby, drill. Not only have times changed, but even back when the phrase was made famous by former Republican vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin in 2008, it vastly oversimplified and understated the efforts required to secure new production. It's easy to overlook how intensive and time-consuming the operation at a well site is before even being able to extract any of those precious crude oil, natural gas, and NGL molecules found beneath our feet. Prior to hydrocarbon production, well sites must be obtained, tested, and developed by exploration and production companies trying to determine their chances of making a reasonable return on their investment. In today's RBN blog, we take a step-by-step look at the leasing process. We recently started a series of 101-style blogs designed to provide a better understanding of the journey those all-important hydrocarbon molecules take from their native formations far underground to their respective downstream markets. In Part 1, we started with the basics of the upstream portion of the oil and gas value chain, from what the sector does to the types of companies that operate in that space. Today, we turn our attention to leasing and the critical role it plays in the exploration process. Before the shale era, E&Ps would explore first to determine the areas that might have the potential to be developed. They would utilize seismic surveys, a topic for a future blog, and other technologies to determine what might be down there, and then if things looked good, drill exploratory wells. For most of the industry's history, producers were drilling vertical wells into capped sandstones, looking for traps, and it was hit or miss as to whether they would find commercially valuable hydrocarbons or come up with a dry hole. So it was drill first, then lease. Only after mapping the formations and drilling the exploratory wells would leasing start in earnest. That all changed with the shale revolution. Shale is the source rock where the oil and gas in the sandstone and tight sands pockets originated before they migrated up into the traps we described before. Producers have known where the shale is for decades and that it held gigantic amounts of oil and gas. They just didn't have the technology to economically produce the wells. What George Mitchell, the pioneer of modern shale fracturing, developed in the Barnett Shale around Fort Worth, Texas, in the 1990s was the technique of getting the source rock shale to give up its hydrocarbons. He showed the effectiveness of using horizontal drilling to reach much more of the formation than using hydraulic fracturing to create enough porosity in the shale to get the hydrocarbons to flow. After producers learned how to differentiate economic versus non-economic shales, the game became lease first, then drill. As laterals got longer, the leasing game turned into one of acreage trading to eliminate what is known as checkerboarding, a problem for drilling the long laterals that are common in horizontal wells. Because the well lateral can only be drilled across contiguous leases held by the same lessee, checkerboarding can limit the length of the lateral that can be drilled, thus constraining the productivity of the well. Oil and gas producers in the U.S. may not have legal ownership of the acreage they are interested in exploring. They may lease or own the mineral rights, but not the surface rights. They have to get permission from the owner of the surface rights acreage, and that's where it can get a little tricky. When oil and gas exploration first started in the 1800s, if someone owned their land, they usually owned everything about it, including the rights to whatever was underground. But after the first Texas oil boom at the turn of the last century in the Spindletop field, there was a growing movement behind the concept of buying and selling mineral rights to the subsurface stuff separately from the surface land itself. A lawyer named Robert Hefner moved from the Spindletop area around Beaumont to Oklahoma and began writing deeds and leases for mineral rights to be traded no matter what happened to the surface ownership of the land. At that point, it began to be common that a landowner might or might not own the rights to both the surface and the subsurface mineral rights. Hefner went on to become, among other things, mayor of Oklahoma City, but in the meantime his model deed for mineral rights became the standard for the oil and gas industry nationwide, and named after him the Hefner Form. It still provides the basic underpinnings of the mineral deeds used today. When a producer wants to gain the right to drill for oil or gas, the first step is to find out who owns the mineral rights. This is typically done by experts known as landmen and supported, of course, by a lot of lawyers. It sounds simple, but it's not. It is very common for mineral rights to be passed down through multiple estates, getting divided throughout many members of the family that originally owned them, then having each of those many members selling their rights to someone else, who might divide them again and sell them to a lot of other entities. The landmen have to track every one of these relationships before they even know with whom they should be negotiating a lease to be able to drill. Then, once all the owners have been identified, the producer, again through the landman, has to get a lease agreement with each owner. Once that's done, access to the land, the surface part, is also necessary, but that's easier. In Texas and most other producing states, mineral ownership is dominant. That means that once a mineral rights owner agrees to allow drilling, the producer can come on the land and often just compensate the surface rights owner for any damage to the land caused by roads, drill sites, and gathering lines. Although getting along with someone who sees a lot of impact to their land but isn't getting a piece of the action can be a little dicey. A mineral lease is just what it sounds like, basically a rental of the right for a defined period of time to drill for hydrocarbons, subject to whatever rules get included in the lease. The producer usually agrees to give each owner a share of the value of what's produced, a royalty, to be discussed more later, and often an additional cash payment up front, a signing bonus. What the producer can do, how long the producer can do it, and what the producer will pay are typically included in three sections of the lease: the granting clause, the habendum clause, and the royalty clause. These three ingredients are not all-encompassing but provide a good basis of understanding for our blog series. Note that not all leases are structured in this trilogy fashion and can vary greatly by geography, negotiating parties, and any other contributing factor. The granting clause is usually the first major aspect of a lease and provides the background information along with what rights have been granted to the interested producer, hence the name. Common aspects of the granting clause include defining the property itself, what minerals can be extracted, perhaps a limitation on the depth of drilling, and easement rights for the producer in terms of use of the land and where the producer is confined to operate. The second common ingredient is the habendum clause, named after the Latin word for to have, which deals with the lease's duration. In the habendum clause, the duration or term of the lease is established, detailing how long the producer has access to the mineral rights. There are typically two different terms defined, the primary term and the secondary term. If the production process has not begun by the time the primary term runs out, typically 3 to 5 years, the mineral rights owner can terminate the lease and take back the rights. However, if the production process has begun within the primary term, the secondary term is activated and the producer retains the mineral rights for that acreage, referred to as held by production, see hold on tight by production. Owners of mineral rights often prefer shorter primary leases so that they can sign a new lease and collect another signing bonus if the producer does not drill. This can create a snag in negotiations as producers tend to prefer the opposite, locking up tracts of land as potential production sites for long periods of time with no pressure to drill, since the royalty fees don't start getting paid until production is flowing to the market. It's worth noting that some companies buy, rather than lease, the mineral rights and don't have to worry about the length of a lease or pay royalties, but they still have to deal with a surface landowner. That approach requires the outlay of a lot more money up front. While both the producer and the mineral rights owner have a vested interest in the terms laid out in the granting and habendum clauses, the real moneymaker for the mineral rights owner is the third key element of the lease, the royalty clause. In this section of the lease, the mineral rights owner is granted a cost-free percentage of the production, or royalty, in exchange for granting a lease of the mineral rights. The mineral rights owner has the right to receive his share of production and sell it, or, as is almost always the case, allow the operator to market the royalty portion and remit the revenue to the mineral rights owner. While leases attempt to establish themselves as an immutable, overarching authority, there will naturally be some disputes when it comes to agreeing on who owes how much, see you never give me your money. Generally speaking, these royalty rates come out to be between 1/8 and 1/4 of the market value of production, less post-production costs. This means that for every molecule produced from the negotiated tract of land, the mineral rights owner is entitled to a percentage of the resulting revenue, less certain costs, compression, processing, etc., to make that molecule marketable. An essential step in the leasing process is what is known as title curation. Once leases are complete, the title to each tract of land is checked for flaws, basically following up on early efforts to find out who owns each set of mineral rights in the first place. The title is traced from the current owner back to its original sale from a government entity to a private party. Documents include plats, ownership flow charts, and tax records. A title attorney then checks the documentation to make sure that state standards are met. Corrections or curative actions may be required, and it may be necessary to track down additional documents and secure affidavits related to ownership, which can be tricky when a family's mineral rights might be split across dozens of descendants. If the curative requirements are met, well site development can continue, with seismic surveys and permitting the next steps in the process. We'll look at those issues in the next blog in this series. Square One was written and performed by Tom Petty and first appeared as the 14th song on Elizabethtown, Songs from the Motion Picture, the soundtrack album for Cameron Crowe's 2005 film of the same name. The LP featured several artists, including Nancy Wilson, Elton John, and Ryan Adams. It was released in September 2005. Square One was nominated for a Grammy Award in 2006 for Best Song Written for a Motion Picture. The song would also appear as the second track on Tom Petty's third and final studio album, Highway Companion. Personnel on the record were Tom Petty on lead, backing vocals, guitars, bass, and drums, Mike Campbell on guitars, and Jeff Lynne on guitars, keyboards, and backing vocals. Highway Companion was recorded in 2005-06 at Bungalow Palace and Shoreline Recorders in Los Angeles, with Jeff Lynne, Tom Petty, and Mike Campbell producing. Released in July 2006, it went to number 1 on the Billboard Top Rock Albums and number 4 on the Billboard 200 Albums charts. It has been certified gold by the Recording Industry Association of America. 3 singles were released from the LP. Tom Petty was an American rock and roll musician, singer, and songwriter. He was the leader of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, and a solo artist. Petty released 16 studio albums with the Heartbreakers, 3 solo albums, and 68 singles. He also released albums with the Traveling Wilburys and with Mudcrutch. Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2001 and also have a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Petty is also the recipient of a Gershwin Award for Lifetime Musical Achievement, a Billboard Century Award, and an ASCAP Golden Note Award. Tom Petty died in October 2017 at the age of 66.
Thanks for listening to the RBN Daily Energy Blogcast. For more information on energy market reports, maps, and consulting engagements, please visit us at rbnenergy.com. And thanks for rocking with us.